Good morning and welcome to the Cheryl and Shirley Show. I'm here today with Michael Jarr. Michael is, in my book, kind of like a little bit of a historian, especially for Wisconsin people. And I want to make sure that we introduce Michael. And thank you so much for coming on the show, Michael. And he's got quite the story to tell us. And I'm excited to share this story.
Well, thank you, Cheryl. Delighted to be on your program. Thanks for the invitation.
Absolutely. Why don't you tell the people, the audience, a little bit about yourself and what your background is and why you're doing this story?
Absolutely. I'll go back to kind of the beginning. I started off as a print journalist back when newspapers actually made money a long time ago. And then I shifted over to public relations and communications. So I got a job on Capitol Hill. I worked as a press secretary for 10 years for a Republican member of Congress. From there, I returned to my home state of Michigan, where I worked for a free market public policy think tank called the Mackinac Center. Then I ended up coming out here to Wisconsin to help the Kern Family Foundation and Genesee Depot set up a communications department. After that, worked for the Badger Institute, another free market, state-based public policy think tank, and worked there for 6 years as vice president for communications. Got a lot of background in communications, storytelling, video production, media, PR, all of that. About a year ago, I kind of hung up my own shingle and was working on a variety of freelance kind of jobs. I just had this story that I had heard that was kind of lingering in my head, and I thought, boy, it'd be great to tell this story someday. And so I just, when you're a freelancer, you have to spend most of your time doing things that earn money. but when I had opportunities, I would kind of tell people about this particular story. Just over and over, people would say, oh my gosh, this is an amazing story. It's a Wisconsin story, and yet I've never heard this. So kind of felt like maybe there's something here. And in October, we got some funding from a very sweet couple in Waukesha that got us on the roads. Yeah, I don't know. Do you want me to go ahead and launch into the story itself?
I think we should, because you're the storyteller, and I can tell you that I met Michael last week. I listened to the story and I was amazed, and that's what started this off was, wow, this story needs to be told. So yes, why don't you just go right into the story?
All right. So the documentary that we're working on is called Liberty at Stake, and it's the story of a man named Joshua Glover. Joshua was a Black man living in Racine, Wisconsin in 1854. He had a job working at the sawmill there. He had a little cabin. And for all intents and purposes, life was fairly good until March of 1854. About 170 years ago this month, a white man walked into the courthouse in Milwaukee and said, this Joshua Glover guy is a criminal and needs to be arrested. A posse was set up with some federal marshals and others. They went down to Racine on a very cold March evening. They knocked on Glover's door. When the door was opened, the posse rushed in. Of course, Glover was, shocked and tried to defend himself from these, people rushing into his home. And he was beaten as a result, bloodied, thrown into a wagon and carted off with no coat into up through the woods to Milwaukee, a good 3 hours or more back in the day. And there was thrown into the jail in the courthouse. So the story could have ended there, but the word got out that about Glover's arrest and about his crime, and an angry mob began to gather outside the courthouse the next day. And the mob grew and grew to about 5,000 people. And they demanded that Glover be turned over to them, over to the mob. Officials would not release him. So this was all taking place at what was known at the time as Courthouse Square. It's now known as Cathedral Square. And the cathedral was being built in 1854. So the crowd took one of the beams and used the beam to batter down the courthouse door, rushed in, overwhelmed the guards, grabbed Glover and still bleeding, and dragged him out into the street. If you know some of American history, you kind of get a sense of where this might be going. What I love about this story is that it's not going in the direction that it appears. It's not a mob justice. Well, it's not a mob justice in the sense that we often hear about, especially in the South. They actually put Joshua Glover on a carriage and they whisked him down to the Third Ward, switched him over to a different carriage, and then whisked him out to Waukesha, which was Prairieville at the time and a very rustic area of the state. And then they hid him for 2 or 3 weeks in people's homes and attics and barns until they could secure a safe passage for him on a ship. They actually brought brought him back to Racine, where this all began. At the harbor there, they put him on a ship. He was hidden, transported through the Great Lakes to Ontario, Canada, where he was released and was able to live the next 30-some years of his life until he was at least 80 in complete freedom. So basically, 5,000 people from Racine, from Milwaukee, from Waukesha, determined that when they heard that a man was going to be returned to slavery, they said, no way is that going to happen. This man needs at least the basic rights that any of us would get, a writ of habeas corpus, mm-hmm. a trial by a jury of peers. The local officials would not accommodate that request. The Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 required that slaves not only be returned to their slave owners, but that people of the state participate, if asked to, in that return. So, whether it's local sheriffs or other agents or whomever it might be, the Federal Fugitive Slave Act said the people in the northern states, if they come across a fugitive slave and that individual needs to be returned, you need to participate in that. Well, the people of Wisconsin said, no, we're not going to do that. And we're going to make sure that he does not go back to a lifetime of involuntary servitude. They literally put their own welfare on the line. Several of them were prosecuted. The court, the trials went on for 6 years. They were sued in civil court. They faced criminal charges. One committed suicide, they think. The other two were bankrupted, lost their businesses, but it was well worth it. So let me just jump back a little bit. Joshua Glover was a slave in Missouri in St. Louis in 1852, worked up the courage to escape, basically, and walked 400 miles wow. to Racine, Wisconsin. Racine was known as an abolitionist area. He knew he would probably be welcomed there. So he took the, a tremendous risk because the slave catchers, his owner, his so-called owner, put out a newspaper award for $200 reward for his return. So people were out looking for him. And you could travel. Yeah, a lot of money.
A lot of money back then.
Maybe a year's salary for some people or a year's wages. Yeah, so he found a good place in mm-hmm. a welcoming place in Racine. But the slave catchers did eventually track him down after a couple of years. And his slave owner went to Milwaukee, said, I need this guy back. That's when things began. So the people in Racine, I think, got word first of Glover's arrest. And one of the biggest, I think the biggest turnout ever in the square down in Racine, it used to be Haymarket Square. I think it's now Monument Square, took place. And they were outraged. They were livid that mm-hmm. he had been taken from their community after a few, a huge crowd amassed there and they gave speeches and they made demands. About 100 people assembled as sort of a reverse posse, got on a boat and were sent up to Milwaukee in an effort to get him back. And the sheriff of Racine was so bold that he was actually planning to arrest both the federal marshal and the slave owner for kidnapping.
Wow. That's amazing. So
it's really amazing. It's just fantastic.
Well, I think what amazes me too is the thought that 5,000 people could be brought together in such a short time. It just seems like that's a lot of people. Now 5,000 people is nothing in Milwaukee, but to get that many people in 1854 is pretty amazing. And then to fight for someone that's a slave and to save him is pretty amazing story. It really is.
It is.
It's amazing that people came together like that. And I like to hear that because it makes me feel better about our history. I think a lot of people don't know our history. This is a big part of it that people have no idea about. And this is way before Civil War. This is before Abraham Lincoln became the president. This is kind of a good warm feeling to think that Wisconsin fought hard. Back then, even.
They did. You could see, it's not only did 5,000 people gather, but they gathered at a moment's notice.
Mm-hmm.
On a cold day, they dropped whatever they were doing. And in a time when, there's no way to spread the word quickly. So the folks in Racine contacted an editor, a newspaper editor of an abolitionist newspaper in Milwaukee. His name was Sherman Booth. Booth, printed out handbills and people began to post those around the city. But he also got on his horse, Paul Revere style. He rode around the city. Yelling out, "Hey, a man's liberty is at stake," and mm-hmm. calling people to show up at the courthouse, and they did. Church bells were ringing, and everyone was alerted to the fact that something was going on. 5,000 people turned out. They spent several hours, actually, writing down. They formed committees. They wrote down, demands that they handed to the local officials. They made speeches. Mm-hmm. There were speeches in English. There were speeches in German. Wow. It was really a fascinating event.
Yeah,
but eventually they just realized realized that this is not going to happen. They're not going to set him free. They're going to find some way to sneak him out, and we'll have no say in the matter. And that's when they decided to take matters into their own hands and
amazing.
Knock down the door. So,
well, when you think about too, like you said, the traveling even. I mean, this was a woodsy area. You didn't have an interstate. You didn't have social media to get things out to people. You didn't have all these things that are available to us today. It had to be very, very difficult to get that many people to know about this situation.
Yeah.
And like you said, the Paul Revere ride, it's basically kind of like that. I can imagine church bells ringing, you know, you watch some of those old shows. And if you're a history buff at all, that stuff is pretty cool to think that somebody would get on a horse and ride, kidnapping somebody basically out of their home and, you know, your own home. You feel like this is a safe place. Yeah, it's amazing. It's an amazing story to me. It seems blows my mind. It, you know, just kind of blows my mind a little bit. I think it's fascinating. It's also wonderful to know that someone is researching and really paying attention to who Joshua Glover was too, and what this was all about, that Wisconsin was on the forefront. I think that's a great story.
Yeah, it is. And the story didn't end there. That's what's so amazing. It would be a great story in and of itself. But there were a lot of Wisconsinites who were really disenchanted with the Fugitive Slave Act. And then in 1854, that very year, the Kansas-Nebraska Act was being considered and was passed by Congress, which would basically allow new states that were becoming states to vote as to whether or not they wanted to become slave states. So instead of the Missouri Compromise, where states below this, you know, in the South could be a slave state, but they had to be matched by a state in the North that was a free state.
Oh, wow.
That was tossed out, and basically any state coming into the Union could vote to become a slave state. So Kansas or Nebraska or California could have become slave states, and that enraged the people of Wisconsin as well. About 50 people up in Ripon, Wisconsin, 9 days after this rescue took place, 53 people, I think it was, gathered at the Little White Schoolhouse in Ripon, which is now a very famous landmark. They were Democrats. They were Northern Democrats. They were Whig Party members. They were Free Soil Party members. They went in there and they said, we need a new political party. Democrats are basically beholden to the slave interests. The Whigs are basically fading out. The Free Soil Party is small. There's a Liberty Party as well, very small and ineffectual. We need to have a new party. And basically, the only thing that really unified them was their opposition to slavery and their commitment to liberty. They were divided on a whole range of other issues, but they felt so strongly and passionately about the need to rein in the expansion of slavery and put an end to it in a country that recognized and was founded on the fact that all men are created equal and they have inalienable rights, which include a right to liberty. The Wisconsinites really believed that and really felt that needed to apply to all people. Alvin Beauvais, as you know, a lawyer and a New Englander who had settled in Ripon, basically, you know, just kind of beat the bushes in Ripon and called people to a gathering at the Little White Schoolhouse and said, let's talk about this. And he said, we went in Whigs and Democrats and Free Soilers, and we came out Republicans. That really was the first incident of a group of people asking for a new party and calling it the Republican Party. There are other places that claim to have, you know, been kind of the birthplace of the Republican Party, Jackson, Michigan, and somewhere in New Hampshire. But this is really the very first gathering, March 20th of 1854, of people who said, we need a new party and we're going to call ourselves Republicans.
And what was just celebrated the 170th birthday, I think?
170th anniversary. Yep. It was just a few
that's
days
great.
Ago.
Yeah, that's great.
It was fantastic.
It was.
I actually went up to the Little White Schoolhouse where they were hosting an event. And there were, I don't know, I would guess about 15 or 16 descendants of people who had participated in that original gathering in 1854. So there were sixth and seventh and eighth generation descendants. There was a little 11-month-old girl there who was, I think, an eighth generation descendant. One of the guys actually spoke and he said, when we have our family get-togethers, you know, when we have like a family reunion and everybody is there, descendants of these folks, he said, it's not just a gathering of white people. He said, there are black grandchildren and there are Hispanic spouses and so on and so forth. And he said, my great-great-great-great, you know, grandfather couldn't have even comprehended the legacy that he established by taking this action, saying, yes, this country really should be committed to one thing, and that is the expansion and protection of freedom for all peoples. So it was really just a very profound moment to hear him talking about that. And then after that, we ended up with a Republican governor fairly shortly, Republican members of Congress, Governor Randall, Camp Randall Stadium is named after Governor Randall, the first Republican abolitionist governor. And then, you know, just a couple years after that, the Republicans nominated a guy named Abraham Lincoln as their presidential nominee. He won. That led to secession and civil war. Lincoln would eventually sign the Emancipation Proclamation, and he would also sign, people don't know this, he would also sign the legislation that would put an end to the Fugitive Slave Act.
Wow.
So, you know, it kind of comes full circle.
Yeah, it does. I think it's interesting sometimes when you think about his speech, Gettysburg, what, it was 2 minutes long or something?
And you can
remember that more than you can remember the man who gave like 2.5 hour speech. What his name is. I think it's something Everett or something. I don't know.
Yeah,
but isn't that fascinating? Right. Yeah, I think it's like Steve Everett or something. But I think it's fascinating that you can't remember his name and he gave this long speech. But, you know, Abraham Lincoln got up and gave like less than 2 minutes speech and he's remembered. And not just because he was the president, but because of that speech. Speech was so meaningful to people. And I just think part of history is we're losing it. And so we need people to tell it. So how did you get like into that, Joshua Glover? Brought you into that? I mean, did you just hear about it from someone or were you reading something or did you catch it somewhere? Because I am a history buff and I had never heard Joshua Glover's name mentioned before. So I think it's fascinating.
I stumbled across it, really. I can't even remember where I first heard about it, but there is a plaque down at Cathedral Square that commemorates the rescue, but it's very brief. It doesn't give you a whole lot of the details. It wasn't until I was actually at an estate sale, and I love history as well. And I was looking through, there was a professor, a retired professor who lived in Fond du Lac, and he had, I guess, gone into like a nursing home and his kids were selling off his enormous book collection. I was there for hours and barely scratched the surface. But while I was there, I ran across a book on Joshua Glover by a University of Georgia professor named Robert Baker. I can't remember the title exactly, but it was basically Joshua Glover, Liberty and the Constitution or something like that. And there was an implication in the title that there was more to the story than just the rescue of this guy, that it actually had some ramifications. So I bought that book and I ended up buying about 24 other books related to abolition and Wisconsin history and so on. And that's where I realized, oh my gosh, there is so much more to this story. It's a great story. There's more to it than, you know, as a catalyst for, you know, subsequent events. It's really quite amazing and quite powerful. And then you think about the Republican National Convention is taking place in Milwaukee this year. So it's a homecoming in a way for Republicans. They are coming back to the state where the need for a new party was initially recognized. The Pfizer Forum, where the convention will take place, is maybe 5 blocks from where Glover was rescued.
Wow.
So I just thought, we've got to not only tell this story, but we've got to start telling this story now. Because what better time? And we've got 40 to 50,000 people coming into Wisconsin. We've got the world's media gathering here. Mm-hmm. Let's tell this story. So we began to work on putting together a documentary. We got a $50,000 matching grant in October from Tony and Andrea Bryant of Waukesha. They were so committed and determined to see this happened that they put that money forth. Wow. And the nice thing about a matching grant is if somebody else donates to this $100, that $100 becomes $200. Or if they donate $1,000, it becomes $2,000. Or if they donate $10,000, I could go on and on. Anyway.
Yeah, right.
But so that got us started. And we've been fundraising since then. Got a producer now who has produced a number of documentaries. We've got a director of photography. We've got a creative design guy who does all of the branding and websites design and so on. Some of the less interesting people, we've got, you know, a bookkeeper and a lawyer and so on. All the things you
gotta have that
to do this.
Sure.
But we are set up as a nonprofit, or we have a fiscal sponsor, a nonprofit fiscal sponsor. Okay. It's a 501c3. So donations can be made to that, can be tax exempt. And so we're just trying to raise money because we really need to start filming. We have done some filming. We've done a lot of researching. We've done a lot of writing. We've got a website set up, but we now need to go out and just do a number of interviews. You know, there's a lot to it. You have to get, you know, either have to buy music or do original music. We're hoping to do original music, maybe using some Black Milwaukee choirs.
Oh, cool.
Who can really kind of give some authentic sound, you know, to songs from that period and so on. And we've engaged some students. There are 5 students who are part of the what's called the Launch Program. That's a cohort of students who are between the Brookfield and Wauwatosa schools, partner with different businesses or entities to work on projects where they can learn and they can also help out that entity. It's got 5 young people who are going to be helping us do the original original source research. So they're going to be helping us track down articles from that period, letters, speeches, diaries, whatever it might be, to help us tell and illustrate the story.
Well, I know when you presented it, you had pictures and stuff with you, which I thought was really fascinating too. So that would be a great addition to it. And I was going to ask you the question of like, why now? Why do you want to bring this out now? You kind of hit on that, but I think you should hit on it some more. And also another thing is, what about getting this curriculum, getting it into like a curriculum-based type thing for schools? Because it's such an important story. And this isn't a Republican, Democrat, Whigs, anything story. Yeah. This is a story about a man's life being saved by a group of people that got together because they believe in liberty. And that's one of the things that I stand for. Totally. I served in the Navy. I'm proud to have been someone who was able to do that. But I do think that we've lost a lot of that. We have lost our direction in that in a lot of ways. And so telling a story like this can be very powerful in bringing us full circle back.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So we can have two steps to this process. We hope to have a 5 to 10 minute trailer that can be shown. We're hoping during the RNC itself.
Awesome.
So we're talking to the host committee. We're working with the state party and so on. So we want to have that done by the end of June, so it can be shown by mid-July at the convention itself, if everything falls into place. If not, we'll show it. We'll still show it at that time, but we may have to rent a room within Pfizer Forum or rent a theater or something. But we want to use that opportunity to do that. The full documentary, which I envision being about an hour to an hour and a half, probably be done sometime in early 2025. That we will then, you know, try to get that on all of the streaming services, the Netflix and the Primes. We'll shop it to PBS and the History Channel. We'll work with partners like 1776 Unites and PragerU to try to get it to young people and or whomever. I mean, this is, like you say, it's not a partisan thing. It's just the kind of story that we need to tell, especially when the narrative is so negative and so critical of America. You know, the narrative, especially on racial issues, is that America is irreconcilably horrible and racist and bigoted. There's a lot of our history that is tainted for sure and needs to be studied and needs to be known by our young people. But at the same time, there's a whole different side of the story that's completely neglected. The story of Glover, there are actually probably 4 or 5 stories of rescues like this taking place in Boston and New York City, and then the Underground Railroad, and then the newspapers that were established, the abolitionist newspapers, the Waukesha Freeman, not far from where I live here in Waukesha County, the Waukesha Freeman was established as a abolitionist newspaper. There's just a rich history of people, you know, working diligently over decades, going back to Benjamin Franklin and Benjamin Rush, some of our founders who, you know, established abolitionist organizations in Philadelphia and you know, Vermont, which back in 1777, before they were, you know, 10 years before they were even a state, abolishing slavery in Vermont, and the other northern states followed very closely on their heels. So there's a rich legacy that really kind of balances out the narrative. And I just think we need to tell the good stories as well as the bad.
Yes, we do.
That's what we're doing here. So, and that's part of why we are focused on young people as well. It would be great for young people to know these stories. So we're working with these 5 students. We do have a vision for creating a version of the video, whether it's a 30-minute version or an hour-long version, that can be shown in the classroom and then actually have some curriculum that accompanies that.
Yeah.
I was talking to someone a couple of weeks ago who was a history teacher and had a design curriculum, who said that she might be willing to come on board and help us with that. So it'd be great to get throughout Wisconsin schools, maybe nationally, but it certainly makes sense to have this in Wisconsin schools. We're also talking about, you know, having maybe high school essay and art contests surrounding the Joshua Glover story.
Great
idea.
So,
you know, encouraging students to write essays in their English or history classes, or the artists to, you know, produce some form of art, whether it's a painting or their own little mini video or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
And then actually having some professors, you know, from UWM or Marquette or Concordia, actually judge them and actually have, you know, whether it's, we could find maybe somebody who would be willing to put up a scholarship or whatever it might be. But we really want to engage young people in this as much as we can.
I think that's fantastic. The part of the story of the 5,000 people that gathered, and like you said, some of them were sued and put in jail and paid a price, a serious price for standing up for liberty. I think that's a story that should be told too, that should be, you know, emphasized, and I'm sure it will be in your documentary. Some of these people, like you said, maybe somebody might have committed suicide. I mean, how horrible. Yeah. You know, you lose your business, you lose your home, you lose everything. It's all for a good purpose, but yet this is what happens in today's world too. We see this. We're witnessing this happening to people, losing their existence basically because they attended a protest or something. And I think that's really
a stand. Yeah.
Yes. They took a stand. Exactly. They spoke out. Right. They spoke out. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that happens. You have a target on you. And I just think that's so, that it's amazing that it's still going on now in 2024. something that was going on in 1852, 1854. It's amazing.
Yeah. Well, and the court cases were really drew a lot of national attention as well. And there was real anger in the South, not only over the formation of this new party, but also of this pattern of the Underground Railroads and the rescues of fugitive slaves. These court cases that dragged out, that there was a lot of anger in the South that Northern people wouldn't just obey the law and return their property to them. They really saw that. And so this whole court case that went on, dragged on for 6 years, continued to kind of rip the fabric between North and South. It was a very high visibility case, and it went back and forth between state courts and federal courts, and ultimately the U.S. Supreme Court, or the Wisconsin State Supreme Court, eventually ruled that the Fugitive Slave Act was unconstitutional and basically nullified the federal law and released the rescuers, which again, it just, you know, you don't hear about this sort of thing. What an unbelievably courageous and constitutional stand to say, I'm sorry, feds, but you got it wrong. This is a violation of the Constitution and the people of, it's the people ultimately who make these decisions. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court obviously didn't see it that way. They overruled the state Supreme Court, and it was actually the Taney Court who also issued the infamous Dred Scott decision. But ultimately, President Buchanan did effectively pardon the rescuers, and so they were able to finally go free, even though they lost pretty much everything.
Stayed in Wisconsin and rebuilt their lives instead of leaving.
Yes.
Well, you know, you fight hard like that, you know, you want to just stay put. I mean, I know in my past doing things for Wisconsin or for the party or for whatever, and anyone, for any person standing up for anyone who's the underdog, I've always been kind of that person that doesn't mind. It doesn't matter. I would have probably been one of those 5,000 people if they would have allowed women to go. Not sure if they did back then, but I would have been one of those 5,000 people there saying, absolutely, this is wrong and we have to save this person, this man. Anyone should have the liberty. We should have that behind us where we don't have to worry about that anymore. And I think in this day and age, we're really seeing that liberty is something that many people don't even understand what it is. And that's part of my passion too, is to make sure that I get these kind of information out to people that they will understand. So I think everything you're doing, Michael, is fantastic. And I think you definitely have your stuff in row and you know what you're doing. And I want to make sure that you tell people where they can help, how they can help, you know, donation, if you have a website or something, or if you have Facebook page, whatever, anything that you can give information on. We would be happy to spread that out there and get that information out to everyone.
Yeah, we have two sites. Our main site is lasfilm.com. So Liberty at Stake, lasfilm.com. The name of the documentary is Liberty at Stake, the Joshua Glover Story. And then we have a donation page you can get to through our website. But if you want to go directly to it, it's at a site called givebutter.com. So it's givebutter.com/Liberty at Stake.
Okay.
Again, Liberty at Stake is the phrase that Sherman Booth used when he was riding around Milwaukee, alerting people that a man's liberty was at stake. So
that's actually where that came from that. Very cool. I like that. That's good.
Yeah.
That's nice.
So if you want to learn more about this project, or if you would like to make a donation, please do visit our website, lasfilm.com, or givebutter.com/Liberty at Stake. We really do need to raise funds pretty rapidly at this point. We've got a lot of people who have been giving money, but we really need to ramp up our team and some of our equipment and getting out into the field to interview people in Racine, in Milwaukee, in Ripon, in Madison. Probably also we would eventually like to get to Toronto to talk to people who about, you know, Glover's the remainder of his life there. We want to go to St. Louis and talk to a historian. So we're going to focus. It's going to be very scholarly piece. It's not going to be, like you said, it's not going to be partisan in any way, shape, or form. We're going to talk to authors and experts and scholars who can really kind of tell the story. But we do need contributions and donations. Mm-hmm. They will be tax exempt because we are working with a fiscal sponsor, which is a 501c3. So any donations will be matched and will be tax exempt. If anybody would like to be considered a producer of the film, a $50,000 contribution would actually have you considered as an executive producer. So, we'd love to have any help we can get.
Sure. Absolutely. Give the website again for donation, or give your website and then it can take you to donation. It's lasfilm.com.
Again, Liberty at Stake. And then the other site is givebutter.com/ Liberty at Stake.
Okay. Well, hey, Michael Jarr, thank you so much for being with me today. I really appreciate the story. I will definitely be sending something because I do believe in what you're doing. And I think it's really tough in this day and age. People need to pay attention to what's going on. And this is a story that touched me beyond what I would have thought, truthfully. It really did. It touched me where I was like, wow, I got to get hold of this guy and figure out how I can get him on a podcast interview and get this information out to as many people as we possibly can. I think this is a story that needs to be told. And I think you've done a fantastic job of what you're doing so far. And I look very forward to hopefully seeing it at National because I hope I'm going to be there. So we'll see. I really appreciate your time too, because I know you're very busy. And I just wanted to make sure I said, thank you so much. Your time is very valuable and I appreciate it. And I just think that what you're doing is a wonderful, wonderful project for the state of Wisconsin, for Glover, any descendants there are. And I mean, I don't know if you've been in contact with anyone in the family or anything, but it's fascinating. And I think it's a wonderful story. Joshua Glover, who was saved by a group of people in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and sent on to Canada and lived the rest of his life in freedom, which I am grateful for. Absolutely. Michael Jarr, thank you very much. Last time, give your website again so we can get some donations for you.
Sure. Cheryl, thanks again for having me on.
Absolutely.
I really appreciate it. And appreciate your audience tuning in. The website is LAS, as in Liberty at Stake, lasfilm.com. And the donation site is givebutter.com/Liberty at Stake.
All right, everyone. So let's bone up here. Let's give some donations. Let's get this going because this is a great story. Thank you for listening to the Cheryl and Shirley Show. You guys have a good day.
Will do. Thanks, Cheryl.